All right. Thank you so much for joining this podcast, Chris. I'm really excited to have you here, and I'm ready to talk about a lot of interesting things with you today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So the first thing I kind of wanted to talk to you about was science. And so how did you, I guess, first get into science? What kind of inspired you to get into science?
So it's kind of funny. I know a lot of people kind of go around and don't know what they want to do with their lives, sometimes even up until college. But I can't ever remember a time where I didn't know that I was at least interested in something related to science. And by the time I was 8 years old, I knew I wanted to work for NASA, right? And at the time, it was like an astronaut. All little kids want to be an astronaut. But I never changed my mind, at least with where I really wanted to go and what I wanted to do. And so really anything within the agency dealing with, at the time, space, I didn't know that there was more than space with NASA at the time. And so I just kind of I always had that curiosity about how things worked. I'm not sure if that's genetic or learned or whatever, but my father was that way too. And then when I got into college, I started off in electrical engineering, which I enjoyed, but I started noticing that with engineering, there was a lot of memorization of formulas, and there wasn't really a lot of like deep dive down into like why these formulas, where did they come from, why do we use them? And so had a conversation with my advisor and moved over into physics. And so I started doing physics, and I absolutely loved physics. It was all the down and dirty that I wanted to know, the problem solving and everything. But as I started going, I started realizing that I was really kind of missing the hands-on from engineering, right? You can't satisfy me is really what I think was going on. But so I went back, I talked to my advisor again, and she let me know that actually that year, my university was starting a brand new program called Applied Physics. And how that worked was I would still take all of the basic courses from physics, but when it came to my electives, I had free rein to pick anything I wanted from any of the engineering degrees. And that sounded amazing. It was like a build your own degree. And so they said, don't worry about any sort of prerequisites. Just give us what classes you want to take and you can go do it. This is our trial and error. We'll figure it out from there. And so I did. I went wild. I picked stuff from mechanical engineering, electrical, chemical, anything I could find that sounded interesting, I took it. And so it was really like the perfect degree for me. And then once I got out of there, I applied for jobs and I was lucky enough to get into NASA. And it's just that's what I've always done. And I've done stuff in between in other like industries. I was going to college, I took a break from college for a little bit, but for the most part, it's just always been science for me.
And so, do you think you were like maybe born a scientist, or do you think you were maybe just born with certain skills that just happen to work really well in the field of science, and so it just kind of set the stage for you, I guess.
In all honesty, I think everybody's born a scientist to some extent, right? I think the basic quality you need to be a scientist is just pure curiosity. And what do children have if not curiosity, right, about the world around them? I think once you get past that age where you have to kind of start figuring out what you're doing and stuff, sometimes that curiosity can go away or it can get, I guess encouraged against sometimes in society. And I don't know, maybe my resilience and not losing that helped me, and just kind of that general, I've always had that wonder on how everything around me works. And even now as an adult, I talk to people and we start talking about something and like, I'm like, okay, cool, let's dig down and figure this out. And everybody's like, no, thanks. Like, how do you not want to know how this works? So that's definitely something I noticed, that kind of separated me from some of the other people around me.
Yeah, I think my wife and I have that kind of relationship where, like, I have a more scientific mind, and then I'm like, I really want to have figure out how things work or why it's working. And she's just like, it works, doesn't
I ask people, I'm like, what would you do if you were just drop down in the middle of the woods somewhere with, there's no society, there's no nothing. How long would it take until you have a working cell phone? And I mean, the answer is never, right? I don't think you could take a person, just drop them in the middle of nowhere and they would get to that far. But it's interesting to think like the level of technology that we have around us that we just take for granted.
Kind of along similar lines, what's something that you wish everyone understood about science?
So as sort of a hobby, I like to do science communication. So, come on podcasts, do talks in the community and whatever. And what I've found is an incredibly common misunderstanding about what science is. And so I think that's really what I wish everybody understood is that science is not a book of answers. It's a process, right? And that process takes kind of the best information that we have at that time, and assuming no human error, it gives us the best possible answer with what we know today. And that doesn't mean that it's 100% never going to change. It just means that it has the highest chance of being the most accurate answer right now, versus any other methodology that we might have to kind of figure stuff out. So the fact that what we know to be true today changes over time isn't proof that science is wrong. It's actually evidence that science is working exactly as it should, right? The entire point of science is to continue questioning what we know. Those questions result in new data, and then that data in turn is kind of turned around and put back into the system, to get us even better answers, right? So science is kind of this self-correcting system over time. I think it's quite literally the opposite of dogma. I think you hear people talk about how science is a religion or whatever, but to me, like no other field, no other belief system in the entire world that I've come across has the same level of kind of logical skepticism and rigor with regard to questioning its own assumptions over time. Maybe some people might disagree with that, but I would challenge them to really look at what they know about science and where they get their science from, because I think the vast majority of people in the public unfortunately get their science from media and politicians, influencers, friends and family, which aren't necessarily the most accurate and valid sources. So I always tell people, go back to the actual research papers and read it for yourself.
Yeah, and I think in this day and age, especially with like social media and stuff, I think the speed at which people want answers is keeps increasing. And science is, it can be a very slow process, I think, sometimes for your average person.
Absolutely. There's a lot that goes on with our science process. And it's interesting because there's some criticism of how science works. And it's interesting because there really are problems with kind of how we do science, but it's not necessarily the criticism that most people have. And one of those things is one, how long it takes to do research, and two, the fact that we kind of put an emphasis on doing new novel research, and we don't have a lot of encouragement to go back and redo those experiments. Because the whole thing with the system of science is you have to have something that's testable by anybody independently, and then comes back to the same results, right? That's what makes it more worthwhile, more valid, more accurate, so to speak. And we're kind of we have a problem with our system about being able to encourage people to do that part, I think. So
So I understand that you're a systems engineer. So what exactly does a systems engineer do?
So it's funny because before I became a systems engineer, I didn't know what a systems engineer did. and I'm really glad you asked this question because systems engineering is something that I don't think gets enough recognition. Most universities don't really teach it, at least at an undergraduate level. There might be a handful of like master's level programs that do degrees there, but I think it's because of how broad it is. I would certainly call it a discipline, but it's more in how you approach problems rather than like a specific field in the way that maybe electrical engineering or mechanical engineering is. You can be a systems engineer in both of those fields. In fact, system engineering can apply to pretty much any industry. At its core, it's about breaking down problems into smaller, more manageable, hopefully less complex problems, which makes them easier to solve, easier to manage, and then easier to break out into teams. When I'm describing it, I kind of like to use like a rocket as an example. So say you're charged with building a rocket. And you've got that giant structure. So you can break that down. You've got the structures, right? That can be one system. You've got the navigation proponents. You've got propulsion, power, payload, whatever it may be. You can take those down and break them, and those are your systems within that overall project you're doing. And you can assign those to kind of functional experts that can work on that. And then those people can take that and they can break those down into even further subsystems, right? And so the beauty about breaking things into systems is that you can work on your system as an expert in any way that you want. And the only real thing you have to worry about with everybody else and what they're doing is the interface. You need to understand the information that's coming from the other systems so that you can work with it. And you need to let them know how your information is coming out of your system so that they can work with it. And then you can piece it together kind of like a giant Lego set at the end. And don't get me wrong, it's not always perfect, but it makes it a lot easier to kind of break down these super complex projects into much easier things to work with. Mm-hmm. So for me personally, I worked in an aeronautical test range for NASA for the past 10 years. So my job was to build, manage, and maintain any system that was needed to kind of get, like any signal or data from a test vehicle into the control room. So like radar, telemetry, video, comms, just that kind of stuff. So that's what I did up until December. And then I've kind of switched more into a project management role temporarily. But engineering is my home. I'll head back there in a little bit. I just kind of want to get some skills from this area. So, but yeah, that's systems engineering in a nutshell.
And so this concept or idea of breaking problems down into its smaller pieces, do you think that's something that people naturally do or is like a skill that has to be taught?
So I think that people do it to an extent naturally, right? But I think being able to do it efficiently and effectively, probably really need to learn the skills to do.
Makes sense. Is there any work done by system engineers that the average person kind of takes for granted?
I think just the fact that the job exists and how versatile it is gets taken for granted. Like I said, most people don't really know what that is. And in all honesty, in pretty much every industry across the board, you're going to find systems engineers. It's a skill set that can improve pretty much any job, in my opinion. So learning those tools is a powerful asset. So if anybody's in the engineering field or really any job that requires you to solve problems or develop solutions, the systems thinking that you can learn there is definitely something I'd recommend.
Okay. Do you have a favorite physicist or other scientists?
All of them. No, I really like learning about Galileo. A lot of people attribute him with having invented the telescope, which he did not. He made improvements on it. Hans Lippershey, I think, actually invented it. But they didn't put any sort of like patenting on it because they thought it was too easy to reproduce. And so he was able to kind of pick it up and make his own modifications. And with it, he discovered all sorts of things, moons, kind of the paths of the planets. And it really kind of supported the heliocentric system that Copernicus talked about, right? Mm-hmm. And because his publications kind of supported that idea, he actually unfortunately ended up sentenced to life in prison by the Inquisition in Rome. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because the Vatican really didn't even like exonerate him and admit that he was right until the mid-90s, like, which just blows my mind of how long that took. Mm-hmm. But luckily for him and us, it kind of turned into a house arrest kind of situation. So he wasn't supposed to like see his friends or publish books, but he managed to do both. And so that was how he got the manuscript for his last book out, which, you know, has done a lot for science. So definitely glad he was able to do that. Random tidbit I just learned actually the other day. Apparently, there's one of his fingers on display at a museum, which is really weird. I guess they move it around. And then when they kind of moved his grave a couple, like a century or two ago, I guess like somebody randomly stole two other fingers and a tooth and just like used it to pass it down as family heirlooms. And it showed up at an auction in 2009. And I guess some private collector picked it up. So I just want to state that I'm a fan, but I'm not that big of a fan. I'm not interested in collecting century old body parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting how scientists sometimes have to go against, I guess, the status quo or the established narratives of the time. So one of my personal favorite scientists is Albert Einstein. Mm-hmm. And even somebody like him with his genius, you know, even he had to go against the grain and really convince people like, yeah, my ideas actually are correct.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's kind of I don't think we quite have the same issue in modern society. Like, don't get me wrong, you have mainstream science that sometimes you have to fight against, but we don't have like the church isn't, you know, advocating for the religious kind of ideology that they did at the time. So if you do something now that's against the church, well, whatever. But then, you know, you wound up in prison or dead.
Yeah. Are you researching anything right now?
So I'm not currently a primary investigator on any projects. Like I said, I've moved over into project management. Right now I'm spending some time mostly doing projects that deal with aerospace, usually with electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicles and other stuff like that. The last research I did was related to superconductors and magnetic levitation. We were looking at trying to build an energy flywheel storage system. Basically, the idea was when you use a regular flywheel storage system, you have bearings, right? And anytime you have any type of material touching each other, even if you use like all the oil and grease in the world, you still get friction, and that means you're losing some of your energy to heat. And so we were trying to figure out a way to reduce that loss. And so what we found is we had a superconductor, which is just a normal material that you get really super cold. We're talking like -300, 400 degrees Celsius. And when you get it to that level, it starts taking on magnetic properties. And so we were able to create this levitation effect. But we found is you would still get what's called flux pinning. It's just kind of how the flux lines of the magnetic field would get kind of grouped together. And it wouldn't be as bad as like friction, but you would still have a loss of energy there. So it was really interesting. And there's some videos on YouTube that you can look at to kind of see how that works. But you can't get rid of all of the energy loss because that violates thermodynamics, but you can get as close as you can. And it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's cool that you mentioned levitation because it's so cool that science has been able to take something like what in the past was considered like, I guess, magician's work, and now we've actually like found a literal way that you can do something that was once thought to be, only be done by like gods or whatever.
Science has always been kind of that barrier between what's known and unknown. And there's a quote, I think it's from Asimov, about, I can't quote it directly, but essentially any future technology would be indistinguishable from magic. And it's really true. If you think about what even just 20 years ago people would think about some of the technology that we have today, it would blow their mind. So yeah,
Yeah, for sure.
it's amazing.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite scientific book that you would recommend to readers?
Actually, I have two that I recommend all the time. The first is called Physics for Future Presidents by Richard Moeller. And the concept of this book is if you were to be president, you would have to have a certain level of knowledge about stuff that is scientific, but you aren't necessarily a scientist. And so it talks about things like nuclear energy, terrorism, dirty bombs, solar power, just like that kind of stuff. And it does a really good job of explaining it at a level that really anybody could understand, especially how those topics would kind of come into play with policy making, right? And so that one's just really good. And it's part that it has about radiation is just phenomenal. Like pretty much nobody who doesn't work with radiation understands radiation, including me before I read that book and really started getting more into kind of the physics behind it. The other book, so can I say a swear word?
Yeah, you're fine.
It's called Quantum Bullshit: How to Ruin Your Life with Advice from Quantum Physics by Chris Frere. And this is I just found this book maybe about 4 months ago, and it's phenomenal. First of all, it is incredibly funny if you can't figure it out from the title, but it kind of serves two purposes. One, at a really low, good, understandable level, it explains some aspects of quantum physics, which, let's be honest, some physicists don't understand. And two, it kind of uses that to better educate people on how to maybe not be so susceptible from kind of predatory people who like to just throw in science sounding words to sell essentially garbage to you, right? About the prevalence of using words like energy or quantum to describe products to make them seem more legit. And so that's kind of where that book's coming from, but I definitely recommend reading both of those.
Yeah, I think especially in like so I'm really into like spirituality, and sometimes you hear people in the spiritual field kind of talk about quantum this, quantum that,
Yes.
and then you'll have the scientists come in later and be like, yeah, you don't know what you're
Yeah,
talking
that
about.
doesn't mean what you think it means.
Yeah.
Literally, quantum just means discrete for the most part. That's the best way to describe it. It just means the smallest part of something. And so
Yeah.
just throwing that in there really means
Yeah.
nothing.
Is there any scientific fact or unknown that keeps you up at night?
So as a general concept, it's just how many things we actually really don't understand. Things like gravity, magnetism, even how lift is generated in aircraft, right? We know how to use it, like we know how to build something that flies, but when you actually get down to the microscopic physics of it, how actual lift is generated, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of people in the aeronautics world, like engineering wise, who think we understand it, and there's two very different, distinct opinions about how that works that don't match each other. But so just really truly understanding how much we really don't know about things, I find just interesting. But I think the more specific answer is the nature of dark matter. Probably one of the biggest things that just blows my mind, because it's sort of this catch-all, right? We look at how the universe and the galaxies are situated, and we recognize that with our current understanding of physics, the only way they can be that way is if there's way more mass in the universe than we can account for. And so we call all of that missing mass dark matter, right? Quote, we can't actually find it, so we assume that it doesn't interact with light and it doesn't interact with ordinary matter. But we define it like it's definitely this real thing that's out there, but it's really just this giant placeholder that's staring us in the face and reminding us that we actually know very little about how our universe works. So I would love to learn more about that.
What are your opinions about space exploration?
As I'm sure you can guess, I'm a big fan for several reasons. First, I'm simply curious. I want to know. I want to see. I want to experience. I'm the kind of person that can't not look in the closed room or the random cave that you yell at the screen of the movies, "Don't go in there." That's me. I'm going in there. I want to know what's in there. You got to stop me from examining the rope or the button that says "Don't pull" and "Don't push." I'm that guy. You're welcome. second, and more seriously, in the long term, it's the only way humans survive. There are dozens of ways that humans could just cease to exist in a heartbeat that we know of, both from our own doing and from things completely outside of our control. So when you disperse to multiple planets, you reduce the likelihood of a single extinction event just wiping out all of humanity. And when you look at super long term, we need to leave the solar system for the exact same reason, because there's still things that make the solar system not livable forever. And so we really, if we as a species want to continue to exist, it's just a thing we have to do. But one caveat to that is we need to be careful, because we really need to make sure that we're learning our lessons here on Earth, so we don't continue some of the bad decisions and things that we're doing and just take all of our baggage with us and destroy everywhere we go, right? So there is that caveat. So there are some people who think that we shouldn't be exploring space because of that reason alone. And I don't necessarily think they're wrong. I just think that it's the answer is be cautious, not don't do it.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I actually had that opinion where I was kind of like, space exploration is important, but maybe our budget shouldn't necessarily so much of it be going in that direction. It was actually Neil deGrasse Tyson that changed my mind on that, because I was watching him on a podcast, and he was talking about how a lot of the technology that your every average day person uses actually comes as a direct result of NASA's projects on space exploration. Like, they'll try to figure out some kind of space exploration problem, and out of that comes out some kind of new math, science, or technology, and then that eventually comes to the general public, and then we benefit from that. So now I'm definitely more so in favor of space
And
exploration.
I'm glad that you picked that up, because so many people don't realize we like, okay, I'm biased. Transparency. I work at NASA. I would like more money for NASA. But even if I didn't, right, the benefit to society that NASA does that doesn't have anything directly related to the space exploration part is phenomenal. Every year we put out a publication called NASA Spinoff, and it's about that thick, and it has all of the different ways that anything that NASA has built, discovered, funded, is now being used in society for other things, even not necessarily what we developed them for. And so it's a really big eye opener. Like, we wouldn't have things like, pacemakers, even funny things like Velcro, like, all that kind of stuff came because of innovation that NASA did, right? Whether it was directly through our research or of the in the past couple of decades, we've really been picking up more on expanding kind of commercial space, right? We've spent, I think I was looking at a stat the other day, somewhere around $178 billion on commercial space, which is almost more than the entire rest of the world combined.
Wow.
But you know, the entire world actually benefits from that. So, but yeah. So, anyways, I could go on that forever.
Do you know if NASA was responsible for GPS, or was that the military?
So it's kind of combined. There's definitely a lot of work that was done in with the DoD, but a lot of it was picked up too through kind of NASA work. You can go through what was it called? I'll have to get back to you, but there's a really interesting website that kind of goes through kind of the history of some of the bigger technological advances like GPS and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting read, but yeah, it's kind of combination of both.
Oh, okay. I can't get anywhere without GPS, so thank you, NASA, for that.
How did people get any place without GPS? We existed without it for the longest time. Did we just not go anywhere?
Yeah. Do you think that we'll ever find extraterrestrial life? And if yes, what do you think it'll look like?
So this is an incredibly difficult question, as I'm sure you're aware, and especially
yeah.
with everything going on currently. So I actually have two answers. So my brain says no. And the reason is kind of the skeptic in me can't help but think about the Drake equation. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But while we don't know many of the variables within it, I think we can reasonably conclude that at least in our immediate area, they're relatively small based on just what we've seen so far. And just to put it out there for anybody who hasn't seen or heard of the Drake equation, it's pretty long. And it basically says that the number of civilizations in which humans could communicate with is equal to basically how often new stars are formed, multiplied by how many of those stars have planets, and then how many of those planets could support life. And then just because it can support life doesn't mean it developed life. So how many of those happen, and then how much of that life becomes intelligent, and then how many of those intelligent life develop some form of communications. And then lastly, how long does that last? Because in for the most part, you know, we have an expiration date, you know. I mean, I guess we think we are the only examples we have of life. But so the idea that some civilization can come at the right time and at the right distance, that we both hit kind of those areas at the right times to be able to communicate with each other. I don't know. To me, it just seems incredibly, you know, small likelihood, you know. And the issue with this equation is that, like I said, we only know some of those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that none of them are zero because we exist. But other than that, like, we're the only example we have. So that answer could be anywhere from near zero to near infinite, depending on what your assumptions are.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it really illustrates that significant point of timing, right? And so I guess to me, intellectually, that seems infinitesimally small.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side, my heart wants to say yes. we can't be the only intelligent species in the entire universe. I truly believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way that we have anywhere near a complete understanding of the foundations of how things work, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what we don't know. But unfortunately, good science can only base things on what we know today. And while we can recognize that there's a lot that we don't know, we can't make assumptions or even expectations related to the nature of the things that we haven't yet discovered. That's just bad science, and it's bad skepticism.
So discounting any conspiracy theories that, you know, maybe we've already made contact, why do you think we haven't heard from anybody?
I mean, that's really the question that instigated the creation of the Drake equation. Somebody put up there, if life is infinite and it's all over the place, where are they, right? And to me, that's where kind of my brain comes in and says, well, the likelihood of us actually being able to, even if, and that's not even saying, again, that it doesn't exist. It's just the likelihood of us actually being at the right time, at the right spot, communicating in the right way to be able to interact with them, right? Right now, our understanding of physics and travel unfortunately doesn't lead to much capability of being able to travel much further than, maybe the next star system over. Certainly not in between galaxies. There would have to be some major breakthroughs and some major misunderstanding of how physics works currently for that to ever happen. And doesn't mean it won't, but right now it's just not likely. So, that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, one of the theories I've heard about why maybe we don't hear from people is because there's maybe like some kind of developmental barrier where a society or civilization, keeps advancing, and then they get to a point where it's kind of like make it or break it, and a lot of civilizations basically don't make it past that line. What do you think about that theory, and do you think that humanity is maybe at that point right now?
So it's interesting. I thought you're kind of going with the prime directive approach there, from Star Trek, where they don't interact until they reach a certain point. But you went left when I thought you were going to go right. So I think that on one side that is a valid thought. One problem with that is, and kind of going back to an earlier question you asked that I just realized is an answer about what aliens look like, is that assumption, it just assumes that any intelligent race that we come across is going to be like us, right? And it has all the benefits and all of the flaws that humanity has. I think that that's an absolutely accurate assumption of the human race. I think that there's going to be a make it or break it point where we either kill ourselves or we figure it out and we keep going. But is that how other races are going to be, right? We can't even tell you for sure if other races are not only if they're going to look like us, but even if they're going to be carbon-based, maybe they're silicon-based, right? There's just no way to tell because we have no other example but ourselves. So, I mean, I guess it's not a bad explanation. I just think that it takes a lot for granted. It makes a lot of assumptions that I don't think we can necessarily make.
What do you think we can do to make sure that we make it?
There are a lot of parts to humanity that work in our favor, and there are a lot of parts that only temporarily work in our favor. And what I mean is, as we evolved, from what we used to be, we were very tribal because tribal is how we protected ourselves from the dangers of all the stuff, all the outside and all of the other. But in modern society, the concept of otherizing things and, this is my tribe and your tribe is bad becomes a hindrance. So I think that we really need to get past that point. I think we're making good progress. I do. But there are still things that pop up that, anytime something new pops up where somebody has any way that they identify themselves as being different from the main group, we go back to that same issue. It's happened with race, it's happened with sexuality, it's happened with gender. Whether or not you agree with any of those things or not, you can't help but recognize that those are catalysts, and we keep going back to the same process of how we deal with it. And we need to not do that going forward. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, that reminds me of Einstein's quote, a crazy person is somebody that keeps doing the same thing the same way and expecting a different
Yes.
result. So yeah, I agree with you. We need to get away from that for sure. Do you have any spiritual beliefs? And if yes, how does your life as a scientist impact your beliefs?
So let me kind of split that into two. So this is how I explain the nature of science and spirituality, because I get this kind of question a lot in my work that I do. For me, science is the tools that we use to kind of observe and describe the physical world. And spirituality is how we describe all the other stuff that we don't know. Throughout all of history, right? Anything that we didn't understand has been magic, has been religion, has been spirituality, ghosts, whatever you want to call it. So science over time has slowly studied what it can and has started to explain the unknown. And so as we continue to do those things, things kind of move from the spirituality scene into the science scene to become more physical, more explainable. And we find out, aha, well, this is what's really happening. And so I think spirituality can exist, but I also think that it's kind of an ever shrinking world. Now, will it completely disappear someday in the future? I don't know. Probably not. But if you're asking me specifically about like a God type being, science is non-theistic. Science is an observation of physical law. And I think if God exists, then they would have to, by definition, exist outside of those laws. So in the same way that you wouldn't use like a ruler to measure how many gallons of milk you have, you can't use science to prove or disprove God. It's just the wrong tool. So for me personally, if I had to place a label on myself, I would describe myself as agnostic atheist. And a lot of people don't understand that those are actually different things. So Gnosticism is about whether or not you think something can be known, right? So Gnostic, it can be known. Agnostic, it can't. I don't think we can ever know, short of dying and figuring it out that way, whether or not a God exists. And then on the theistic part, it's about belief. Do you believe or do you not believe? So as an atheist, I don't believe that there is a God, at least in the same sense that like the Abrahamic religions describe one. Now, is there some great power beyond that? Maybe, but I have a hard time seeing how that relates to anything I'm going to do. It kind of exists outside of what's my concerns are, because I don't believe in this, intricately interconnected thing with people. I just, there's too much going on. But with all of that said, there are plenty of scientists who believe in God or godlike beings. So, like I said, science doesn't mean that there can't be spirituality or religion.
Yeah, Spinoza comes to mind, somebody who had a very scientific mind, but also had a very deep spiritual life as well. And I think Einstein even said that if he were to believe in a God, it would be Spinoza's God.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think about the simulation hypothesis that maybe, we're living in like the Matrix or something similar to that? Or do you humor any other kind of alternative theories like the many worlds theories?
So, this is personally my opinion. I'm not a fan of the simulation hypothesis. I find it very unscientific. For me, this is more a philosophical idea than an actual physics hypothesis. And it relies heavily on the same kind of logic that many conspiracy theories do, I find. Essentially, it creates this kind of circular thing built in, such a way that like it's impossible to ever disprove it, because the entire premise is that this simulation would look, feel, smell, and act exactly as our universe acts, right? It's kind of a catch-all. And the few attempts that I know of to even test that theory, like Silas Bean out of University of Washington back in like 2010, sometime in there, he published something, and the result of it was that the advocates of this simulation theory or hypothesis just thought up new versions that countered the criticism, right? It's really sort of counter to the way that good science is done. Good science observes something, right? And then it defines a hypothesis that can be tested, and then over time it confirms it or disproves it. With simulation hypothesis, I feel like people just invented a supposition that they continuously change to get around legitimate criticism. Honestly, I think that the physics community, specifically those who actually do research as opposed to the subsection who make a living off of maybe selling books about questionable futuristic ideas, it's not really regarded well, I think, in my opinion. And then also, honestly, I have to wonder what's even the point? I understand like fully studying something purely just to understand how it works. But that comes after observing its existence to begin with, or at least something that makes you think it exists. I understand studying something just to understand it better, so we might be able to utilize it and learn it, something from it to better humanity. But what's the point of imagining something that has no observable evidence, and it wouldn't in any way affect how like we moved forward, except maybe to possibly negatively impact people's mental health, right? Could you imagine a world in which we just suddenly knew that we weren't real? But now we're back to a philosophical question. But so that's that. And so I don't get much more into it than that. Other things like the many worlds theory, I think it's better. It's much better received, I think, in the physics community. But ultimately, it still lives more in the philosophical discussion than actual experimental or theoretical physics. But kind of, I guess, for people who don't know, to understand it, you kind of need a kind of a quick brief in some things in quantum mechanics. So if you take like an atom, and an atom has an energy state, right? It's got an angular momentum or some component of an orbital angular momentum. But you don't know what they are until you measure them. So you have a wave function. And essentially, a wave function is a mathematical model that just represents every solution that it could be, all those values that it could be before you measure it. That wave function kind of takes into one mathematical formula. So the key in quantum mechanics is that things are discrete, like we were talking about earlier. So if I ask you to pick any number, there is an infinite answer you could give because numbers are both infinite and continuous. You could stick with whole numbers, one, two, three, you can go decimals, whatever. But if you're looking at energy states in quantum mechanics, they can only be specific values, right? That's what makes it quantum. And that's what discrete means. So a wave function just encompasses all those discrete solutions that that answer could be. So once you measure a variable, like say energy, the wave function collapses to a singular value, and that's the value that you measure. And that's the only energy level that it can be right now, which corresponds to a specific orbit. So when a wave function interacts with the world, essentially it collapses down to this single eigenstate. And essentially, the many worlds theory is based on this idea, this supposition that what if the universal wave function doesn't collapse? What if all of those possibilities are physically realized somewhere and we just only see the one that's manifested in our world? So there are layers upon layers of parallel worlds for each one of those possibilities. And kind of in layman's terms, they expand that out beyond quantum physics, right? Which happens a lot to explain concepts. And I think people don't always necessarily understand the difference between reality and analogy, which is 100% on the shoulders of scientists. But so they talk about every time you make a decision, you could possibly make spawns a parallel world. And I have to remind people that we're talking about the quantum realm specifically and the stuff there, right? But we see that same kind of mistake when it comes to like things like entropy, right? And about disorder and order. Entropy is really about temperature and energy, how much energy is available to do work. But so analogy can be our friend and it can be our foe in understanding stuff. So that's kind of just a real quick run through on many worlds theory. I think it has merit enough to continue. Maybe I'm biased and I'm just more interested in that one than the other one. I don't know. But I also find that, like I said, generally amongst the physicists, I feel like that's more well received than the simulation theory. And I think Neil deGrasse Tyson even said once that he's just not smart enough to understand the simulation theory. And maybe that's my problem too. Maybe I'm just not smart enough to understand it. I don't know.
And so, along similar lines, do you think that when it comes to string theory, are physicists heading in the right direction, or do you think maybe that's a good theory, but maybe we should be looking elsewhere as well?
So, I'm going to preface this with I'm not a string theorist. I don't stay up to date on that. My general understanding is that string theory has met a stale period of discovery to the point where a lot of people are questioning whether or not it's valid to keep going. I don't know if that's necessarily still true. That's kind of my understanding. I do think kind of the idea of the simultaneous particle wave thing. I mean, I think we see that. You can see that in the light split experiment, right? So I think that that's legitimately something to keep going with. I just don't know the ramifications of what their inability to show things exist that they would need to kind of show that they're still on the right path, if that makes sense. Whereas in particle physics, like, they still do things like what is it called? I'm sorry, I just blanked. The gravity particle, Higgs boson. Like we find stuff like that still through the Large Hadron Collider and stuff like that. To kind of show that all of these things that we predict exist are over time still popping up, and it kind of shows us that we're still heading in the right direction. And I think we're missing that in string theory right now. So.
Yeah, string theory has always been interesting to me because, kind of going back to what you mentioned earlier about ramifications for society, like particles, atoms, things like that, like I get, and it doesn't necessarily like freak me out. Like if my hand is made out of little tiny balls that are stuck together through forces, like that doesn't freak me out, right? But if string theory gets proven true, it's like, whoa, like my hand is made out of these things, these little strings that are vibrating. Like that
Depending
seems
on how
more
they
like,
vibrate is how things are. Yeah, that's
yeah,
it
like
definitely gets into the realm of the wild, I agree.
Yeah, to me that one's like really mind-blowing. So next I want to move over to AI. AI seems to be the big topic these days. Do you think science might be going a little bit too far, or doesn't know maybe when to push the brakes, when it comes to AI?
So, kind of the two parts that are we going too far and does science know when to push the brakes? I almost feel like are different questions. I think the enthusiasm behind scientists is really high. And if you let them, they'll just run with things. But as a global community, I gotta say, like with all scientific discovery and engineering development, the knowledge itself isn't good or bad. So are we going too far? That's a question that I feel like constantly gets asked throughout history, and it should be. But at the dawn of pretty much every major scientific discovery, gunpowder, nuclear power, satellites, medicine, cloning, now AI, and presumably everything else coming into the future, we're going to ask this question, and we should. With regards to AI, I think there's kind of some important things to remember. First and foremost, that while AI has made a staggering amount of leaps in the past several years, most of what you hear is sensationalism propagated by media amongst people who are now being introduced to AI and don't fully understand it. AI has been around a very long time. And it's, don't get me wrong, it's been nowhere near as advanced as it has been now. We've legitimately made large leaps, but it's still, I don't think, at the point where the doom and gloom people are, advocating for, holy crap, we're going to be taken over by AI. I don't think we're anywhere near there yet. Like with all things, as a society, we do need to have that conversation. Similar to what happened with cloning, we now use that technology completely different than people feared we would be after the first, cloned sheep. And I think AI will be the same. For me, AI is going to help us be exponentially more efficient with our time, taking over lower level tasks so that humans can spend more time doing those things that we're truly good at. Which is the complexities of imaginative problem solving and complex evaluations. Humans are just good at many things that AI is just still nowhere close to even doing at a mediocre level. Critical thinking, creativity, empathy, dexterity. AI is really best at repetitive tasks and data-driven tasks. So I don't think that we're going too far. Is there the potential to go too far in the future? Like with everything, yes, but I'm more scared of how human beings are going to use AI than I am of what AI is going to do on its own.
How far do you think we are maybe from general human intelligence?
If you want to say real artificial intelligence, if we get there, it's going to be an accident. And the reason that I say this is because one of the fundamental agreements between philosophers and neuroscientists is that we don't even understand consciousness in ourselves yet. And if we don't understand it in ourselves, how can we possibly deliberately recreate it in something else? That's kind of my personal opinion. That being said, this latest advancement utilizing machine learning and neural networks was a major advancement that, at least from those not in the industry, seemed to kind of come out of nowhere. So if we were to have, so there's a guy, I can't remember his name, but he's been advocating for the we really need to be careful about AI, kind of like very, he's not anti-AI, but he's definitely one of the doom and gloom people that I'm talking about. But when he talks about estimating timelines in AI, he doesn't use years, he uses advancements. And he says that we're 1 to 4 advancements similar to what we've just experienced away. I'd say we're probably closer to 2 or 3 of the level that we just experienced before it becomes something that we need to have the conversations definitely right now that people are saying we should be having right now. But for the most part, everybody has to remember that the AI that is in the world today that we are using is generative AI. It is the baby low level, not the advanced level. All that is doing is looking at all of the data that's already out there and putting it together and summarizing it. And if you feed into it how you personally summarize, it basically just use statistics to evaluate what's the most likely way that they would produce these sets of words in a row. It doesn't understand what the words mean. So that's something that we need to keep in mind. We're still at the generative AI stage. We are not really at the true artificial intelligence stage. So
And the term is language models, right? That
language models,
these
yep.
things are basically just language models, are taking known, I guess, processes about how languages, the logical conclusions to certain
Yes.
phrases, and just
It's pure
spitting out stuff.
probability is all
Yeah.
it is. It's not understanding, it's not consciousness.
Got it. What advice would you give to a young person who's interested in going into science?
Be curious, explore. One of the biggest things that I had to learn for myself is that there are many different paths, both to science and even once you get into science, there's not a right way. I've worked many jobs, like in medical, in the military, in IT, like for quite a while through my life. So you have to find the path that gets you where you want to be, and don't worry so much if it doesn't look like somebody else's path. So that's the one thing that I would say. The other thing I would say is that our education system isn't the worst, but it's not always the best either, especially if you don't necessarily learn in the traditional way that we teach. So if you've gone through your educational system and you're out and about and you have a bad taste in your mouth for math or history or something, just keep in mind that there are other ways to learn those things. I've actually just myself gained a new appreciation for history over the past 5 years that I never had before, because I realized history is actually a lot more fun to learn when you don't have to worry about memorizing dates and names and whatever. When you just find something you're interested in and then you see the history of that, it starts to come alive and you start to understand things better. So don't be afraid to go back and try and learn differently something that you thought you didn't like. You'd be surprised what you find out that actually you do not only like, but have an aptitude for.
Yeah, and I think the presenter can sometimes make a difference too, but I also agree with you that not having to, I guess, maybe take a test next week can also affect your ability to absorb information. Because I've noticed, like, on a lot of science videos that I watch, there's always the comment, I learned more in this video than I ever learned in my high school biology class or whatever. So I think when people are curious about something and there's not that pressure of, oh my gosh, I'm going to get graded on this, people are actually interested in learning about science and maybe pursuing that path.
Definitely, absolutely. And we are luckily in an era where information is everywhere for you to get. You have to be a little more careful about making sure you're getting good information, but
Yeah.
the good information is also out there. So,
Do you have a favorite YouTube science channel that you watch at all?
not necessarily science, but engineering. I like Hacksmith, and he essentially is a phenomenal engineer and builder. And I wouldn't say that he builds anything necessarily practical, but the kind of the problem solving and the creativity and the curiosity that he has, he's recreated a lot of things from like Marvel. He's done a lightsaber, he's done Thor's hammer, the Batarang, like all sorts of crazy stuff he does. But he does it really well. He does it in a methodical, well thought out, and high quality way. And so I personally love watching his stuff.
Do you think we'll ever be able to engineer a lightsaber?
I guess that depends on how you define it, right? There are probably at least 50 different designs that I've seen. And what they do is they'll usually ignore one aspect so that they can get all of the other aspects, right? So you'll have some of them, you want to be able to create this lightsaber looking thing. And you want to be able to control how far it goes out, right? Because if you're using a laser, the laser is just going to go. You can't just end it at the end. And so they'll hook up like gases to it to create like a plasma torch, basically, so they control it by the pressure of the gas. But then you have to have a tank of gas on your back, right? In other ways, you can do it, but the temperature that you would have to get the plasma up to and how you would have to maintain it, you'd have to have a wall of batteries next to you, right? So I think it's possible. I don't think we're there yet. That's what I'll say.
Gotcha. And one other question I did want to bring up, only because it was in the news recently, and you mentioned earlier that you do work at NASA, correct? On Friday, there was a NASA press conference where they tried to, or they released a report on UAPs. And I know on the internet, we kind of mentioned conspiracy theories a little bit in this podcast. And maybe you can't share everything being an employee, but what did you think about the NASA conference? Do you think that NASA did a good job in addressing, I guess, public concerns that there's, information being withheld from the public and things like that?
So another thing that I get asked a lot, so I can talk about it. I'm not involved with that, and I have to always be very clear that in this role right now, I'm not speaking for NASA. I'm speaking for me, Chris, and my experiences. So there's kind of a couple of parts of that. One, I think that they did the best job that they could do. I think there's a lot that goes into what can and can't be said that has nothing to do with conspiracy. But when you are already preordained to think that everything's a conspiracy, that's what you're going to take away from it, right? So in my current job, there's lots of things I can't talk about, and none of them are bad because we're hiding things necessarily. So a lot of it just has to do with proprietary information that private companies own. So I can't tell you their private stuff that they own because I would get fired, get fined, potentially go to prison. In other aspects, it's a matter of national security. And I know that people don't like that answer. But when you look at kind of the clearance levels that we have in the United States, top secret, secret, and whatever the lowest one is, my mind's blinking. Sorry. Haven't had enough coffee today. But how they are defined is 100% based off of how much damage they could do to our country if the wrong people got a hold of it. That's it. That is the only qualification, and it's incredibly subjective. It's like minor damage, severe damage, incredibly severe damage is basically how it's laid out. And so we have a lot of stuff that, because you can't, once it's out, you can't control it. So the best you can do is be cautious about what you let out in those moments. And so we have to be careful there. But one example I like to share that I find incredibly hilarious and asinine and purely bureaucratical, but an amazing example of what most of the stuff is, right? So Canada, the Canada Space Association, developed the Canadarm. It's a robotic arm, and it went on the International Space Station. They designed it, they built it, they handed it to NASA. NASA took it up and put it on the International Space Station. At some point, like all mechanical systems, it started having problems and needed some repair. We cannot give that back to Canada because of ITAR, because of a law that exists. And ITAR is primarily developed to protect against things that are like missiles or weapon systems and stuff like that. That's its primary. But there's just enough stuff that are related to the Canada arm that we are legally not allowed to give it back to Canada, even though they designed it and built it. So that's just kind of it's dumb, right? But that's the kind of stuff that we can't do. Like, people will go to prison if we do that. And it has nothing to do with trying to keep secrets from, the American people. But again, like I said, if you're prone to believe in conspiracies, as soon as you're not allowed to know something, that's where your mind goes. And a prime example of that from that conversation, is during that brief, they didn't want to release the name of the person who was selected. And literally the only reason why they didn't want to know to do that is because in the UFO or, whatever you want to call it, community, there are a lot of very intense people. There have been death threats. There have been acts of violence done on people in the government who have been associated with this in some way, even people who aren't actually associated with it. Somebody gets a name, an idea, somebody looks like somebody, and that stuff happens. And so, to some extent, there is a responsibility of people who work for the government, like myself, civil servants, to serve the public. But that shouldn't take away our right to be safe. We shouldn't get killed over a position we hold at NASA, right? Or damaged, or our family threatened. But once, I don't know what happened on the back end, but they did come back and update the release, and they named the person that was selected. And so I would just ask people to be aware of how much there is going on that has nothing to do with anything nefarious on why certain things can't always be released. But one thing I can tell you is that these things have time limits on them. Eventually, just like all those reports that have come out over the past couple of years, it will come out. Some of it will be redacted only if it has a direct effect on national security right now or still. But eventually, it all comes out. So I think they did the best job that they did. I think that people need to understand that of all the reports that we get, and when I say we, I don't mean NASA, I just mean in general, of all the reports that we get, some high percentage that I don't know off the top of my head, like in the high 90s, have been categorically proven to not be aliens. What the conversation is about is that less than 1% that haven't been cleared. And really, what it comes down to is those things, yes. Something's going on. Everybody acknowledges something's going on. But the problem is there just legitimately is not yet enough evidence if you're being a proper scientist and a proper skeptic to say, yes, this is aliens. All we can say is we don't know. There are several different things it could be, and we haven't been able to rule out any of those things yet. So we don't know. And that's where we're at. And as we move forward, we've created this area within NASA that's supposed to be helping doing these investigations. I personally, again, biased, I feel like of all the government agencies, NASA is probably one of the most benevolent. We are not part of the DoD. Most of our research is accessible through various ways by the public, unless it's working directly with DoD or private companies, like I talked about before. So I hope that we can see a lot of good research going forward from here. But again, at the end of the day, there's just a large group of people that they're only going to be satisfied if they hear what they already believe. And if what they already believe isn't what's being said, then the response is going to be conspiracy.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, Chris, before I let you go, where can people find you or get a hold of you?
So I'm kind of all over the place. So my primary podcast is called A Dash of Science, and it exists everywhere. We've been in hiatus for a little bit. I got myself a new co-host, so we're going to start creating new episodes here in about 2 weeks. You can also find me on the Wisdom app, where I do live talks at least weekly on scientific topics, and communicating stuff like that, just stuff that I learn about and whatever, wherever it brings us. That's a really fun new app, so I definitely recommend that. You can find me on Twitter, or X as we are calling it now, at Physicist Chris. Under that same handle, I'm also on Twitch. So when I start doing live streams again here, once we start doing our podcasts, you'll be able to see me there as well. And then you can always just email me at chris@dashofscience.com.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join this podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. We've had some great questions, so I really had a lot of fun.
All right. Have a good night.
You too.